The Arkansas legislature is in recess today for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, but we'll be back at work tomorrow.
I don't know what's going to happen with this. There was a critical race theory ban, quote unquote, in the Arkansas Learns bill, and a judge kind of struck it down and then also kind of ruled that the wording was just so vague that it didn't really ban any kind of speech. So I don't know how they get around the First Amendment when writing this.
A preview of the second week of the 95th General Assembly on today's Ozarks at Large. It's Monday, January 20th. I'm Kyle Kellums. Also today, a multi-decades trip through Arkansas.
Fort Chaffee is the largest refugee camp in the U.S. with a population of some 21,000 now.
And an effort to give up-and-coming bands a place to play in Fayetteville. First, this news from NPR.
Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art presents Knowing the West, the first major traveling exhibition to examine how people see the American West. This exhibition closes January 27th. It explores untold stories of the West, including those of Native American artists, women, and more. Tickets available at crystalbridges.org.
A pleasant Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, January 20th, 2025. I'm Kyle Kellums. It was on this day in 1901, Margaret Pittman was born near Prairie Grove. She and her siblings sometimes helped her father administer vaccinations to his patients. After earning her first degree at Hendricks College, she embarked on a medical career that would lead to her developing a vaccine against whooping cough that is still the scientific basis for our protection against the disease to this day. She lived until 1995 and is buried in the Prairie Grove Cemetery. You can learn more about Margaret Pittman and so much more about Arkansas history at encyclopediaofarkansas.net. Later this hour, Randy Dixon from the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History gives us a preview of what we'll see Thursday night for our in-person version of our weekly tours of Pryor Center archives. Plus, Ozarks at Large's Sophia Narani talks to a pair of musicians working to make sure developing bands have a stage in Fayetteville. And we get ready for a new season of the podcast, The R Word. We'll start today by examining the completed first week of the 95th General Assembly of the Arkansas Legislature and the upcoming second week. Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore talked with Josie Lenora, the politics and government reporter for Little Rock Public Radio, about lawmakers' goals and the legislature's second week.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Matthew Moore. Last Monday was the first day of the 95th General Assembly of the Arkansas Legislature. We are joined today by Josie Lenora, politics and government reporter for Little Rock Public Radio, who spends a lot of time at the Capitol, a lot of time speaking with lawmakers, and she's here with us today on Ozarks at Large. Josie, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Matthew. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, so we've talked about how last week there was not necessarily a ton of action that happened. Really, the kind of highlight thing that happened in the legislature was from someone who's not even a legislator. We heard the State Address from Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Kind of the 30,000-foot view here for our listeners. What were the main takeaways for you from this speech?
Yeah, the governor's been pretty cagey about what her plans are for this legislative session. She said that she wants to do something with higher education, but she hasn't been particularly specific about that until Tuesday when she gave that speech. And she gave us a pretty good sample platter of all the issues she's going to cover. I would kind of categorize them in two places. I think she's really concerned about child welfare. So there's a lot in here about keeping children safe and feeding children. And then the second group seems to be stuff that's kind of playing more towards her conservative base. So that's she wants to expand the Communist China Defense Act. She wants to pass something called the Defense Against Criminal Illegals Act. She wants to pass something about woke professors. So, or in her words, woke professors. So that's, I think, the two big categories of things we're going to see coming out of the legislature. And as we know, the legislature almost always does what Governor Sanders wants, with the exception of probably gutting the Freedom of Information Act, but they've been pretty keen on passing her laws in the past.
Yeah, so let's kind of take those one at a time here. Let's start with child welfare. One of the things that she's promoted and we've seen bipartisan support on is free meals, and specifically free breakfast in Arkansas schools. Let's talk a little bit more in detail about that if we can.
Yeah, I was in Tippi McCullough, the representative's office yesterday, and also I talked to Senator Clark Tucker about why this was a piece of legislation that they're passionate about. It's bipartisan. Those are two Democrats I talked to. They said that they consulted with some people at, like, the Hunger Relief Alliance, and they researched it, and they decided that school breakfast was the best thing to make universal. Arkansas has a little less than 300,000 kids getting free or reduced school lunches, and they decided to focus on universal school breakfast first. About 8 other states do these universal meals. And part of it was just, you know, Tippi McCullough, she was a teacher. She actually was my 9th grade English teacher. And she talked about what it was like to have students come to school that were hungry and they couldn't focus or pay attention. And so for them, that's really exciting and something they're really passionate about. I've noticed that the governor seems a little bit more interested in programs that are these kind of social programs. She seems a little bit more interested when those things have to do with children. So the bill will allow for kids to opt in to a free breakfast. It won't be probably delicious. I mean, we remember that public school food, but it'll be, you know, scientifically nutritious, and that'll help them start the day.
And I think one of the things that I'm sure, you know, Representative McCullough pointed this out as well, is that removing the stigma of certain kids qualify for free and other kids have to pay for their lunches, that can be a stigma for kids who get free meals. So I think making it free and available to everyone is an easier way to get the kids who really need it to take an action, right?
Yeah, and we also have this video, you know, Minnesota passed this universal school lunch, and apparently they ended up needing more money for it because there was an over-enrollment in the program. They didn't expect some people to enroll. So it's possible there's a lot more people who could benefit from this program that we just don't know about because of the stigma or because they don't want to for whatever reason. So it'll be interesting to see how many kids sign up. They have $30-ish million from medical marijuana money that they're hoping to spend on this, and that should be enough if you look at other states with similar programs.
So let's look a little bit at the second column here, where we're talking about kind of these ideas that she has that are kind of feeding into her base on the right. One of the things that she talked about, and I think got a pretty good amount of publicity, was the conversations around indoctrination from professors at universities. Do we have any idea of how this law could really kind of become a piece of legislation? And what have we heard from folks who might be impacted by it?
What's interesting is I actually can't find a DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion program in any public Arkansas college. There's a few multicultural centers. That's a little different. There was one at my college. It's not the same thing. I don't know what's going to happen with this. There was a critical race theory ban, quote unquote, in the Arkansas Learns bill, and a judge kind of struck it down and then also kind of ruled that the wording was just so vague that it didn't really ban any kind of speech. So I don't know how they get around the First Amendment when writing this legislation. It's interesting to me because I could see a situation where they end up banning certain speech or they ban indoctrination, and that kind of puts them in some kind of legal hot water. So I don't know how this is going to be worded, and I don't know if they'll have any teeth to it, if they'll be able to enforce it. And she didn't give any examples in her speech. It's hard to pin down what she meant by woke professors.
As we start to wrap up here, let's think about we've seen a lot of legislation that has been proposed. Much of that was filed before the session even started. As you look at some of the bills that have been proposed, what sticks out to you that is worth keeping an eye on?
This one, I think it's been filed yet, but the Social Media Safety Act, the governor's been really interested in banning cell phones in schools. You know, she's a mother. She's met with Jonathan Haidt, the writer of The Anxious Generation. She's talked a lot about this. And I know the LRSD was actually considering an almost identical policy, but they're waiting for the governor. So that'll be interesting to see. I spent a lot of this year, past year, going to LRSD town halls, talking to people about the cell phone ban policy. And I found almost universal support for it. There was a couple of arguments that some teachers liked letting kids screenshot the PowerPoints and stuff like that in class. But other than that, I mean, almost everyone supported banning cell phones in schools. So it'll be interesting to see, A, if that passes, B, if it's able to be held up in court because a similar bill that she tried to pass last time was struck down in court, and if it really does have any kind of impact on kids' mental health outcomes across the state.
Another category that kind of leans into this child welfare part that we were speaking about earlier is maternal mortality. This has been a big talking point in Arkansas for the last couple of years, honestly. We've seen places like the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences and the Alice L. Walton School of Medicine here in Northwest Arkansas taking some action, doing some work to really prioritize this. Legislatively, are we seeing any priority put on maternal mortality?
Arkansas is the only state that doesn't give you Medicaid after the first 30 days of giving birth. So there's two bills that would extend that for a year, which one of them is Aaron Pilkington's bill. He's a father of three. He also works in hospital management at UAMS. So he's really interested in expanding that to a full year. Andrew Collins, who's a Democrat, put forward an almost identical bill. So that'll be interesting to see. The governor doesn't seem super keen on expanding Medicaid. She did a task force about maternal mortality recently, and she kind of made the argument that basically we just need to inform more people about the existence of Medicaid instead of expanding Medicaid. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not those two things passes, considering that the governor doesn't seem super keen on that policy, but it does seem like something that has some bipartisan push.
And finally here, we've seen a lot of conversations about the proposed prison to be built in Franklin County in Charleston. Have we seen any sort of legislation that will prevent that from happening? Does this seem a bit like a done deal at this point?
Senator King wants to try to stop that legislatively. It'll be interesting to see if he's successful. He kind of goes alone. I've been to a few press conferences he's had where he's kind of really called out his colleagues and been very critical of the modern Republican Party, which he sees as not being particularly conservative. So I don't know where that's going to go. Even if they did build the prison, one thing that's interesting to me is they just don't have the people to staff this. There's going to be more people in the town than there's going to be in the prison. More people in the prison than there will be in the town. So part of me is like, are they just going to build it and it's going to be this big empty warehouse and no one will work there? I don't know. I mean, there's not enough place to house everybody. So I'm trying to get to the bottom of why they picked that piece of land when other places wanted it. And I still am coming up empty. So, you know, she talked about it in her speech. I mean, I think it seems like it's moving forward, but there's going to be a lot of logistical issues and money problems as it goes on. Brian King wants to pass a law so that instead of building the prison, we just give the money to existing prisons to expand. Instead of building one big prison, because prisons, I mean, if you've ever redesigned your kitchen, you know that construction projects often go over budget. And there's one in Alabama that went in, I think, over $1 billion, and which is way more than they planned to spend. So,
well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on that. I know that our listeners here in Northwest Arkansas are very invested in the details coming out about this story. You can hear all of Josie's reporting from Little Rock Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll have you back next week to do another wrap up.
Thanks for having me, Matthew. It's been fun.
Walmart is celebrating the reveal of the company's new 350-acre headquarters. The campus was shown off Friday. According to a company press release, the complete opening of the headquarters is a phased opening approach that will continue throughout the year. The inaugural celebration marks the commencement of that phased open strategy. The campus includes a welcome center, a food hall called 8th and Plate, street-facing retail space, and an amphitheater that will be used for both campus and community gatherings. The new headquarters, first announced as a project in 2019, located in downtown Bentonville. The city of Fayetteville is teaming up with the nonprofit Pedal It Forward to offer a new location for dropping off used bicycles. The Fayetteville Recycling and Trash Collection Department will be a year-round donation spot for used bikes and accessories from 8 until 5 every Monday through Friday. Governor Sanders will be attending the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland later this month. She's scheduled to be on a pair of panels while there, including one with Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear to discuss governor's priorities and state's roles in times of presidential transition. She'll also be part of a panel discussing smartphones, social media, and youth mental health. The World Economic Forum scheduled for January 22nd through the 24th. The Walton Arts Center reports more than 500,000 patrons attended a public performance, school show, or special event at its venues in 2024. The year-end report also shows more than 26,000 students and teachers were part of Walton Arts Center education initiatives, and more than 3,200 tickets to events were donated to nonprofits and agencies serving Northwest Arkansas residents. The organization sold a total of more than 385,000 tickets for events at the Walmart Amp and more than 117,000 tickets to events at the Walton Arts Center on Dixon Street.
The continued progress of Arkansas depends on the continued improvement of the state highway program. And the Arkansas Highway Department, with the support of the people, is developing a highway system which meets the requirements of today and will keep pace with the bright future that looms ahead.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me, Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Welcome back.
Thank you, Kyle. Good to be here.
And of course, we just heard an archive from the Pryor Center.
And it's one we've heard, well, I'd say we've heard it before, not that particular clip, but we've used that in the past. It's an old 1950s highway department film. They would make one every year. They had a dedicated photographer who would travel the state the entire year, and they would chronicle highway department projects, but then would throw in a little travel log throughout the state. So I threw that in because we have a special program today.
We do.
About the KETV archives.
And it's special because it's also connected to something you and I are doing Thursday night.
This Thursday, the 23rd, 6 o'clock at the Pryor Center. It's a little live presentation we're going to do. It's a live in-person video version of this program.
And we're going to go through the decades.
Yeah,
Thursday
you know,
night.
We've done this in the past. This
Three
will
or
be
four
our
times, yeah.
fifth
yeah.
or sixth one,
oh,
I believe.
Wow. Okay.
But we usually will go by a topic or topics. Mm-hmm. We do like a story from the archives on entertainment or one on politics and one. So thought this time maybe we could do it by the decade.
I like it.
And that way we can get in a few more stories. And I went through and kind of found the top stories from each year from 1950 to 2000. So I figured we could cover five decades in this hour evening and just kind of show off what we have in the archives because later this year, all 26,000 hours of KETV's news coverage and all of the material that's been collected will be on the Pryor Center website in a searchable fashion, and you can just find all kinds of interesting material from Arkansas's past.
All right. So that's going to be Thursday night, 6, at the Pryor Center. You don't have to pre-register. It's free. Just come on by. Let's give a preview. Now, we've heard from the 50s. The 50s, important for KETV. That's when they signed on.
That's right. And here's one of the issues with the archives. KETV signed on December 19th of 1953. Started broadcasting newscasts every day and collecting film archives because everything was shot on news film at the time. In 1960, there was a fire, I believe it was October of 1960, that burned the Channel
Everything.
7 building to the ground, including all the film. So it was almost like 1960s, they started fresh, or we started fresh. But there is some material from the 50s because Jim Pitcock, the news director, not only was saving all the film that KETV had produced, but would find different items here and there, whether they were films by the state, like the Highway Department film, or even home movies. One of those people, Francis Cherry.
Former governor.
Yes, from the early 50s. His family gave KETV some home movies of his 1953 inauguration. And so here's one clip from that. Steve Barnes, actually, when we got it, Steve Barnes was the anchor, and he looked at the footage and ended up doing a report using this footage. And here's some of the audio from that. And this is one of the things we'll be showing Thursday night.
It was a clear day and beautiful. Thousands came to the steps of the Capitol to catch a glimpse of the festivities, and thousands more were unsuccessful. Television had yet to impact on politics in Arkansas, and an inaugural was a major social event. It brought high school bands and senior classes. When he took the oath of office, Francis Cherry was something to see. Prematurely gray hair flattered the former chancellor from Jonesboro, who had denied Sid McMath, the reformer, a third term.
Well, let's move to the 1960s now, where there are archives because this is post-fire.
Yes, yes. So we'll be able to pick up a little more. There's a little more content, a little more depth to the archive. This is actually a Corps of Engineers film. KETV did cover the event, but it was all silent films. So this is a film archive that KATV found of the Greers Ferry Dam dedication in 1963, which was actually about a month before
the murder of President Kennedy.
Yes, in Dallas. So here's an excerpt from that film that you'll be seeing.
The crowd cheered as President Kennedy moved to the front of the platform to receive the honors and ceremonies attendant to the office of the President of the United States. Ruffles and flourishes and hail to the chief were played, and the crowd gave a standing ovation to the distinguished visitor.
I appreciate the fact that we've had this opportunity to join together in dedicating this project and committing it to the service of the people of Arkansas and to the service of the people of the United States. This project, others like it, I think must be developed in this decade so that the United States will continue to be the most beautiful and best country in the world. Thank you.
So now we move to the 1970s. Now you're really beginning to get to the point where you've got not just silent film, but a robust collection.
Sound, color, all the advancements that come. You make the transition from film to videotape. So a lot happened in the 70s, and a lot of news happened in the 70s. Here's a clip from 1975. Vietnam War was coming to a close. Americans were pulling out, and there were refugees from Vietnam coming to America. Mm-hmm. And many of them, thousands of them, came to Fort Chaffee. And here's a report from ABC News of President Ford visiting Fort Chaffee and the Vietnamese refugees.
From the moment his motorcade entered nearby Fort Chaffee, the roadway was lined with smiling and cheering Vietnamese. There were occasional signs with messages such as, "Vietnamese fishermen thank President Ford." Fort Chaffee is the largest refugee camp in the U.S., with a population of some 21,000 now. After a briefing, the president quickly toured the camp, beginning with a residence barracks and a daycare center where children were studying the English language. Outside, another group of youngsters getting their introduction to English through song. The president was asked for his reaction. He called it inspirational to see people getting an opportunity to be part of America. The grateful but anxious Vietnamese had their own reaction to the president's visit.
We went and hear anything he said to our people for today. And tomorrow we will leave United States, you know.
The final stop was at the camp hospital. The president told that overall the health of the refugees is better than that of residents in an average American city of the same size. The stop at the refugee camp speaks for itself, the president reaffirming his commitment for these people to have a new life in the United States. But the trip also features a chance for the people of this area to see the president and for a private meeting with Republican leaders, all that a stereotype for other trips to come on the road to Campaign 76. Steve Bell, ABC News, with the president, Fort Chaffee, Arkansas.
We're again hearing some stories from each decade, 50s through 90s, that we'll be featuring Thursday night at the Pryor Center, 6 o'clock for free. Other things happened in the 70s. There's Watergate.
Right, and a lot of that was related to Arkansas. You had prominent politicians, Wilbur Mills, McClellan, Fulbright, that were involved and outspoken about Watergate and Nixon's resignation. In 1976, when we had the bicentennial, Johnny Cash came home and had a big celebration that was actually covered by Geraldo Rivera for Good Morning America. Gas prices were through the roof.
For their time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And then we ended that decade with the Iranian hostage
which
crisis.
Leads us into something from the 80s here.
A lot of things from the 80s. Yeah. Well, their release, of course. And we did have, of course, Arkansas was related to this big national story because two of the, I believe it was 90 hostages, were from Arkansas. Mm-hmm. So here's a report, and you'll recognize this person, a young reporter from KATV doing a local story on the hostage situation in Iran.
The theme of a popular song brought the mothers of hostage Robert Blucher and Stephen Kirtley together at the governor's home this afternoon. The yellow ribbon will stay on the tree until the men come home to their native state. First Lady Hillary Rodham arranged the ceremony to signify that the state will not forget the two men, no matter how long they are held captive. Blucher's mother, Mrs. Hazel Alban, says she still hears from the State Department daily about the situation in Iran.
Yeah, I heard from them yesterday.
What did they tell you?
They don't tell us anything, do they?
Well, they really haven't found out anything yet.
They don't know what to tell.
They haven't heard anything new that they can tell us. It's more or less a call to reassure us. So, you know. So that's what we're waiting on.
Do you think that even though they probably have moved him, Mrs. Kirtley, that Stephen is probably still safe? Or do you have any idea?
I really don't know because we haven't heard anything. But I don't feel that they have really heard him yet. They're holding him. I think that's their security, by holding him.
There was some talk that possibly they might try another rescue attempt, that it would be maybe easier because they were separated. What do you think, that would be a good idea?
I don't know. I feel sort of, I'm afraid, but still, you're always hoping something will happen. But I'm still afraid what might happen if they do go in.
Neither of the ladies have heard from their son since the aborted rescue attempt. Mrs. Alban did write Robert a letter this week. However, she figures it'll never reach its destination. Larry Foley, New Scene 7.
Larry, of course, now a multi-Emmy-winning documentarian professor at the University of Arkansas.
Yes, and an old friend of mine because, of course, I used to work there with him.
Right.
And you've worked with him for years.
Right. All right. Now, the last decade we're going to cover or participate with is the 1990s.
Right. We're going to go all the way up to the 21st mm-hmm. century, so I just figured we could stop there. But, a lot of things happened in the 90s, mm-hmm. and it was Clinton for a lot of it.
Right, for most of it.
He announced for president. He won the presidency.
Won it again.
Yeah, as a result of that, Whitewater happened.
Right.
Because of Whitewater, Jim Guy Tucker, who had become governor, had to resign, which brought in Mike Huckabee, a Republican governor. So the 90s were big news in Arkansas, too. And speaking of news, it was also the decade that the Arkansas Gazette died. So let's hear from Walter Hussman at a news conference the day the Democrat took over the Gazette.
Basically, today, the Gannett Company permanently suspended publishing operations of the Arkansas Gazette. And they have, shortly before we had this press conference, have notified all the employees there that they've been terminated. We have acquired all of the Gazette's assets here. We are not buying the Gazette as a business, as a going concern. Frankly, we can't afford to. The Gazette was losing far too much money, and we just literally, even if we had wanted to, we couldn't do it. But we did want to buy their assets. And basically, Gannett decided that they were going to leave Little Rock. And they decided they were either going to sell the Gazette or B, close it. And they talked to us and asked if we would be interested in buying the Arkansas Gazette. And we told them that we really couldn't buy the Gazette. We really couldn't afford to buy the Gazette. The Gazette is losing so much money. But we told them that if they were going to close the Gazette, that we very much would like to buy their assets.
I think we're going to have a blast.
All right, so it's Thursday night at the Pryor Center, which is on the Fayetteville Square. Begins at 6, absolutely free, no pre-registration required.
Right.
Just show up, and we'll have a good time.
Oh, it'll be great.
Parking on the square is back to normal. Lights of the Ozarks are being, they're off.
And there's also the deck.
Right.
That you can park in behind the town center.
Right.
So, yeah, come on out. It'll be fun.
All right, we'll see you there. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. See you Thursday night. Then we'll come back and do something else next Monday.
See you then.
One thing that's out for 2025? Feeling overwhelmed by an endless barrage of headlines. Let Morning Edition be your one-stop shop for staying informed about the news of the day. We bring you a mix of national and local stories so you can stay up to date on the new presidential administration and what's happening in your community. Take control of your news this year and start your weekdays with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition every weekday morning from 5 to 9. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals will be led by a new field manager in 2025. The club announced Brooks Conrad as the eighth manager in Nats history. Conrad played professionally in both Major League Baseball in the United States and the Nippon Professional Baseball League in Japan. The Naturals will open the 2025 campaign in Tulsa on Friday, April 4th, host their home opener Tuesday, April 8th against Frisco in Arbest Ballpark in Springdale. A series of state athletic championships will take place in Northwest Arkansas later this year. The Arkansas Activities Association awarding the 2025 State Basketball 6A Tournament to Springdale High School. This year's 6A Track Championship meet to Bentonville West and the 6A Soccer Championships to Bentonville. Additionally, Greenland and Jasper will serve as hosts for the 3A and 1A championships in baseball and softball.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Daniel Carruth, joined in the studio today by two hosts you might know if you listen to some of KUAF podcasts. I've got Lowell Taylor, Justin McGowan from The R Word. How's it going, guys?
It's going great.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good to be here. Not to, you know, lift the veil on anything, but we just finished recording the last episode for The R Word for this third season. How does it feel?
Yeah, it feels good, Daniel. It's been a really fun season. Season three, as we mentioned in this last episode of the season, it's been a season to talk primarily to practitioners, people who are doing things here and across the country. So it's been really fun. I've really enjoyed this season of the podcast.
Yeah, I will echo a lot of that. As people who are theorists in some ways, but also desire to do the work of activism, on the ground work of pursuing church-based reparations, to be able to engage over the last season with people whom are doing reparatory work across the country has been a very exciting experience to have, because if you're local doing this, you might feel crazy, like you're the only person or the only people who are doing it, and then you have this kind of new world opened up to you, that there's a lot of people who are pursuing this in different places and spaces across the country. And so we're just one of those groups of people here in Northwest Arkansas, but we had the reminder every episode that we are connected to a much bigger movement and network that's bubbling up and gaining steam across the country.
Yeah. And so for this next season, you have someone that you're adding on to the podcast. Can you tell me who that is and a little bit about them?
Yeah, we're adding Reverend Dr. Jonathan Pastor Jay Brooks. He is the pastor of Lawndale Community Church in North Lawndale in the city of Chicago. I'm also the head of the Lawndale Community Development Association. And so they are doing a lot of work in the west side of Chicago in their community. And it's beautiful to be able to find a partner. He reached out to us earlier this year because he heard about the work that Zacchaeus Foundation was doing. And he was finishing up his doctoral work, did his dissertation on the Zacchaeus Foundation, Zacchaeus Fund, and was told to look us up. And so that was the point of contact. And then since then, we've gotten to know each other and build a relationship. We were able to invite him on, and he's, excited to join us. And so he's going to be a very vital voice and a different voice that adds to the conversation that we're having. So we're excited.
Yeah. And well, something that's interesting about your podcast and about The R Word is I think after 2020, a lot of these conversations and probably a lot of podcasts about racial justice, about even reparations maybe started to come up. I don't know that all of those have lasted the way that you guys have and are still going, ongoing, and are also really targeted and niche, and what you're talking about is very specific. Can you talk a little bit about that work and maybe how it's evolved for you guys over the past 3 years?
Yeah, Daniel, I think that's a good point and something I'm really thankful for. The opportunity that we have not to run a sprint, but a marathon, and to run that marathon at a marathon pace. And, you know, we've had people on the podcast like Aria Florent who have reminded us that this work really is generational work. And so on one hand, we've been doing this work for a long time, 3 years of the podcast. On another hand, we've been doing it for a very short time. But I am thankful that, to your point, Daniel, a lot of people for different reasons started the work of racial justice after what we saw in the summer of 2020 and then haven't continued to do it. So we're fortunate to get to continue to do it. So I'm thankful for that opportunity.
And it's interesting, too, because I think what you guys have done in a lot of ways is you very directly address something, too, which is reparations. And I don't think a lot of the conversations I hear around this maybe skirt around it or don't directly address it and talk about it and what that means and lay it out in such a clear way. And I think maybe for the listeners that's been helpful or been to separate it from some of the other noise that's out there. I don't know if that feels accurate on your end.
Yeah, and I think that's intentional. Mm-hmm. I think Lo and I, especially myself, have been a part of racial justice work for a long time, and to where conversations around reparations were kind of like this final destination of the journey. And we really experienced the faultiness of that logic and doing racial repair in that way. And this is something that we're going to talk a lot about in the next season of, hey, we are starting where a lot of people have designated the finish line. And I think it allows us to have the conversation in a different way, because it makes us ask the question, are we all in on repair? Or are we really pursuing something that's less than that? And if you're pursuing something less than that, you know, you can do that, you know, over there. But over here, we are about the work of pursuing holistic racial repair, and that begins with reparations.
And something people can look forward to in this upcoming season. But also, you guys have an event coming up as well. So can you tell us a little bit about the screening that you're having?
Yeah, thanks for that, Daniel. So we have a few events coming up in Q1 of 25, but I'll speak primarily to what we're doing in January. So on Thursday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. At the Fayetteville Public Library, we'll show a film called The Big Payback. It's a really well-done PBS documentary about reparations in general. And our friend, Robin Rue Simmons, specifically, and her work for reparations in Evanston, Illinois. Robin's a friend who we've interviewed on the podcast previously, just last month in November. We, Dustin and I, and a few others from Fayetteville had the opportunity to visit her in Evanston, Illinois at a conference. And Robin has agreed with her staff at First Repair, the organization she started and leads, to train folks here in Fayetteville about reparations to help us as a community write a racial equity plan, which is something the city of Fayetteville agreed to do back in 2020. So working with our friends on the Fayetteville City Council, DeAndre Jones, Council Member Jones, led the passage of a resolution whereby the city agreed to receive training from Robin and her staff. And so the film is a wonderful opportunity for our community to be introduced or reintroduced to Robin and her work.
All right, guys. Well, anything else you want to add, say, think people should know?
You can learn more about Dustin and I our work for reparations and the Zacchaeus Foundation on our website, thezacchaeusfoundation.org. There's links to our website on all our podcast episodes, which are on KUAF.com too.
That was Lowell Taylor and Dustin McGowan, hosts of the KUAF podcast, The R Word, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth. Lowell and Dustin are hosting a free screening of the documentary The Big Payback at the Fayetteville Public Library Thursday night, beginning at 6. Tomorrow on our show, sounds and voices associated with this weekend's observation of the Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, plus what we need to know about bird flu in Arkansas, and Shannon Wurst will be the next featured performer in the Shine Through Winter Room Listening Series at Underbrush Books in downtown Rogers. We'll catch up with her, and she'll play for us in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. All of that on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large. You can listen to us whenever you'd like by accessing our free podcast version of the show. You can do that at your favorite podcast platform. And you can always hear the most recent daily edition of our show by asking your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large.
On the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. On the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride.
You're listening to Lead Belly with Rock Island Line and Ear on the Soundbeat.
Right, you got to ride it like you're fine to get your ticket and sitting on the Rock Island Line.
Originally recorded by John Lomax in 1934, this song featured Kelly Pace and Arkansas State Prisoners. No, that's not a cool band name. The father and son musicologist team of John and Alan Lomax often visited prisons to record inmates. On one such visit, they met a young man by the name of Hughie Ledbetter, known to history as Lead Belly. No one's quite sure how he got the nickname. Some say he took a round of buckshot to the stomach. Some that it was a dialectical change from Ledbetter. Bluesman Big Bill Brunzi claimed it came from his reluctance to engage in chain gangs, as if with a stomach weighted down by lead.
I may be right and I may be wrong, but you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. On the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. On the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. On the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
Find out more about Lead Belly's prison exploits right now at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Libraries. I'm Brett Barry.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Hope you are having a pleasant and meaningful Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Also hope you are staying warm today. Rafe Box and Sabin Heiss are two artists participating in a benefit concert taking place on February 8th at Waystone Pizza off of Garland Avenue in Fayetteville. The concert is raising funds to repay the costs of purchasing a sound system that was previously housed at Smoke and Barrel. That's a recently closed bar and venue space that was on Dixon Street. Ozarks at Large's Sophia Narani recently spoke with Rafe and Sabin about the meaning behind moving the sound system from one venue to another, and about the importance of creating spaces for musicians to cut their teeth.
With the closure of Smoke and Barrel recently, like, there's kind of a big need for a place like this, somewhere that bands kind of in our little like DIY kind of group and kind of, I don't know, I guess like that grouping of artists, we kind of need a place that we can play at that is not like, maybe not quite like the size of George's, right? Or like JJ's or something like that. A little bit smaller and just like kind of a homey place that we can all kind of gather around at. And Waystone really kind of fit the bill, right? But they didn't have a sound system. So this whole show, that's kind of like the goal of it, right? Is let's take this, you know, local business and help kind of like lift it up, give it the ability to host these shows that, you know, bands can come and play at.
Yeah, and definitely that's the important thing that we're talking about is accessible stages. And like you mentioned, with the loss of Smoke and Barrel, that's an important venue to the community. And I think that, you know, some people may not really understand how that process works. So you couldn't necessarily start a band and then just go ask to be on the George's stage.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about how that would work traditionally versus kind of what you guys are hoping to create at Waystone.
Well, you need I kind of like the way I like to phrase it sometimes is like when you're first starting a band, right? And especially like if you're a newer musician as well, like you need a place to go and be able to not be very good, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You need a place
practice,
that you can,
you
know,
learn.
Cut
your teeth.
Yeah, yeah. You need a place to cut your teeth, right? And so like for a long time we had like Backspace, you know, we had La La Land, and then Smoke and Barrel was kind of like the next step up from that, right? Where it's not completely DIY, but the people that are running it and the people that book there and like, you know, they're allowing people from the community to really kind of like they're taking a chance with someone that maybe like, you know, hasn't booked somewhere before. And then obviously you have like the people that are booking there all the time and then the artists that are playing there all the time. But you kind of need that stepping stone, right, for artists to grow in the area, right? And so this, I believe that Waystone can really kind of fill that spot. So that's kind of what the goal is here.
Yeah, and both of the places that you described are places that no longer exist. Backspace, the Quonset Huts, which I've talked about on the show before. I actually wasn't around for La La Land, but I've heard great things about it.
It was such a funny little... I don't know. I mean, it was just kind of like this little building that you wouldn't even think was anything, you know. I mean, but it ended up becoming something really special, you know, just like Backspace and just like Smoke and Barrel. And I think that Waystone will be able to eventually get to that point. One of the other main things, too, that's really cool about Waystone is that it's going to be all ages because it's also a restaurant, right? I mean, it's a restaurant first. So that's another, like, huge reason why I'm, like, really excited about Waystone is because Smoke and Barrel was great, but it was also, you know, 21 and up. And so now we have this venue that is going to be even more accessible to the people here, and that's, like, what more could you ask for? You
also, know? The parking is phenomenal.
Yeah, the parking's way
it's
better.
It's a lot better.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
And
yeah.
It's free.
It's free. You don't have to pay for it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's a, you know, a large aspect of it, too, having that younger audience, that those younger musicians coming and having the opportunity to attend these shows and to be a part of these shows, which would necessarily be let into those places at all. So it's great to have Waystone as a steward for that.
Absolutely. And I will say, too, that, like, I mean, I think that, like, more and more all-ages shows are able to happen in general right now. I mean, like, George's is even doing all-ages events and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. that's, like, I don't know. I think it's really important to recognize that younger people need to be able to get in to see this kind of stuff because, like, I mean, I can't even, like, if I was, like, 16 and I wanted to see a local band around here and I couldn't, I mean, there's a lot less chances that I would end up becoming a musician later, you know? And
exactly.
It's like you need to have
yeah,
people.
Yeah, both of us started before, you know, we were 21 playing in bands.
Yeah, I was in a band when I was, like, 14,
yeah.
You know? And, like, if I wasn't able to go and see bands, like, why would I even think to do that, right? So
going back a little bit to the benefit show, can you tell me what people can expect to see? Obviously, you both will be performing. Tell me about the bands. And
yeah, we got 8 bands. It's a good thing that we have so many good bands around here that I would like to play this, but it's also a bad thing because then I had to choose, right? I wanted to have a spread of genres. It's not as wide as I initially wanted to, so it's kind of a heavy show, but there's a lot of bands, and they're all full of, like, really good, genuine people, and they're very enthusiastic. I'm excited to see all of them.
Yeah, you know, and I think that reflects the music community here as well, is that it's uncommon, maybe, in places to have everyone get along so well, and that might be a generalization, you know, obviously, but Fayetteville, it seems, people lift each other up.
Yeah, well, I also think it's kind of funny because, especially with heavier bands, there's kind of this tendency of, like, a lot of people from heavier bands have, like, branched out to do other things that are not heavy music at all, you know what I'm saying? And then you end up coming full circle to where, like, those artists are kind of, like, playing and performing together and stuff like that. There does tend to be, especially with larger scenes and stuff like that, in bigger cities maybe, there tends to be kind of, like, a tendency to group together with similar sounding artists. And obviously there is here as well, but all the people that are involved on the booking side of things and on the artist side of things as well, I feel like everybody that I meet and that I interact with is so genuine and just welcoming and accepting of everyone and like wanting to work together towards like this greater cause of just building the local area and making sure that not only like the people that are living here now, but even just like the next generation of people are going to have a place to play, a place to go see music, a place to connect with people, a place to meet, you know, friends to make a band with. I mean, like, it's just, it's really important to keep that going, so.
And I think that that is reflected in this show as well, mixing a bit of genres, hearing different sounds, which you might not necessarily hear in a traditional venue.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, ideally the purpose that this is going to serve, is it should show people, like, hey, you know, if you didn't know about Waystone before, now you do. This is a place that bands can come and like, you know, hopefully maybe not necessarily a very curated like pairing, you know, but just like more of a, I mean, it's spontaneous is probably not the right word, but to an extent, you know, like of just like, hey, this is just three or four bands that are playing tonight. Maybe you haven't heard one of them. Maybe you have heard one, but they've got new music out or something like that. And you can go and check it out and it'll be $10 or $15 show. And it'll be at a place you can go get some pizza that's really good. Hey, you can bring your kids. It'll be kind of a more accessible environment, right?
I'm so glad to hear this, and especially with what I've heard just around town about the low spirits of Smoke and Barrel closing and just the attitude of less spaces and the diminishment of that. So
yeah, it's we're running dangerously low on viable venue spaces around town, and it's yeah, I mean, something's got to be done about it sometime pretty soon. So hopefully this will help out and give everybody a new avenue, right?
Thank you so much, you guys. This has been great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Ozarks at Large's Sophia Narani talked with musicians Rafe Box and Sabin Heiss about their upcoming benefit concert at Waystone Pizza in Fayetteville. The concert is raising funds for a sound system allowing for live concerts and music events at Waystone, taking place on February 8th. For more information about the event, you can look for Waystone Pizza on Facebook. And stay tuned for another conversation with Ozarks at Large's Sophia Narani and local music promoter Joe Swink. They'll be discussing his experience in the Northwest Arkansas music industry, as well as the need for accessible venues. That's on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. A celestial body is newly named with the help from a public radio program, Radiolab. A quasi-moon of Earth now has the name Cardia. This new name comes after a naming contest sponsored by Radiolab and the International Astronomical Union. Radiolab producers say suggestions for the name came from more than 100 countries, and Cardia was then selected by a vote by more than 10,000 people. Cardia, by the way, the Roman goddess of doorways and hinges. The new name replaces the old one, which really didn't roll off the tongue. It was 164-207-2004-GU9. The winning submission came from Clay Chillett, a second-year student at the University of Georgia. By the way, you can hear Radiolab Saturday afternoons at 2 on 91.3 KUAF and Sundays at noon on Little Rock Public Radio.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Can you hear yourself?
Yes.
All right.
That's good. This is the first
you like
time
it?
Experience. Oh, Hamid Al Alamat.
Hey, everyone. My name is Shelby Stone. I'm from Conway, Arkansas.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jaya. I'm a senior here at the University of Arkansas.
So my name is Janessa. I was born and raised here in Northwest Arkansas.
Hi, my name is Isaac, and I'm from Springdale.
Hi, my name is Emlyn. I am Chiquise. I'm from the Pacific Island.
KUAF's Listening Lab is a space for honest and intimate conversations to help us better understand our neighbors and ourselves. You can find a full archive of conversations and stories from people in your community online now, and find out how to have your own story heard when you go to KUAF.com/The Listening Lab.
Ozarks at Large is a production, 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday edition of our show included Matthew Moore, Daniel Carruth, Sophia Narani, Josie Lenora, Randy Dixon, Lowell Taylor, and Dustin McGowan. Our theme is titled The First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. I'm Kyle Kellums from the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville. Thank you so much for being with us. Another brand new show for you tomorrow.
The Scott Family Amazium in Bentonville invites adults 21 and up to celebrate the season of love Tuesday, February 13th for a pre-Valentine's evening of playful discovery and connection with beer and chocolate pairings, imaginative hands-on stations, and interactive activities for a date night or a gathering with friends. Details and tickets at amazium.org.